Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we've got a bonus episode for you.
We do, because Saturday is all right for a bonus interview.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like my song that I just kind of, I like reading songs. I had a whole idea for a series where you would just like have a conversation based on song lyrics.
I think it could work.
I think it would be hilarious.
Oh, man. All right. Putting this in our Ideas for Terrible Podcasts podcast.
I think it's excellent podcast, but okay, we can quibble over that later. As you know, we went to Asheville and we interviewed so many people and we got so much great content that we thought we would run interviews in their entirety, almost.
Just about, yeah, and let you get the full feel of what folks said. Of course, we will be pulling, you know, the particularly relevant quotes from them into our episodes. But yeah, today we're giving you the interview that we did with Kevin Frazier, who is a historian in Asheville. He's the executive director of West Carolina University Programs in Asheville.
Yeah. He also owns mm-hmm. a board game bar?
Cafe.
A board game cafe called Well Played that I am still upset we did not get to play any board games there.
Oh, I know. Or get their cocktail list looked really good. He's also the founder of Asheville by Foot, which is a guided tour company around downtown Asheville, and the author of Legendary Locals of Asheville, which is a book about Asheville's history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he very well could be in his own book. Or another, maybe the sequel one day. Someone else will write it because you don't really want to include yourself.
I guess, yeah, that's a little bit gauche.
A little bit. And we wanted to start with this one because while we did go on a much anticipated and enjoyed Comedy Ghost Tour, that was a great foundation for information. He was the historian we went to put the history of Asheville in context. So he's kind of less about food and more about history, but it was very useful when we're trying to understand how Asheville, the food scene and the beer scene, how it became what it is.
Yeah.
So this is much more history focused, but very fascinating.
It is. Oh, yeah. We couldn't help but present it to you because we loved it so much.
And we hope you enjoy it.
So I grew up in Asheville. And when I grew up in Asheville, this was not the place to be. It was a really rough town. It was a city in the 1970s that had really completely collapsed. At that point, because of suburbanization, but because of a weak financial position it had been in since the Great Depression. And so things were, most of the buildings were boarded up. The highlights were pawn shops and porn stores and porn theaters. I've got a great photograph from 1985, as late as 85, of the Fine Arts Theater, which is one of our independent film theaters. And the two features that day were Sassy Sue and Three on a Waterbed.
Oh, my goodness.
Those are not allowed by law in North Carolina anymore, have not been for many years. But it was a place your mom told you that you hadn't lost anything and you didn't need to go back to find. You just avoided downtown. I grew up in these parts and then I went to college at UNC Asheville and then went away to grad school and I went away to study African history of all things. And I did. And I teach African history now and then. But I got interested in the history of cities and the history of American cities and happened to trip across a fellow by the name of John Nolan, who's one of the first professional city planners in the United States, and happened to do a project in Asheville in the 1920s. And it's a crucial project. His plan for Asheville, which was a very early plan, I mean, we just think of city planning as part of city government. In the teens and 20s, cities hired a planner like you and I'd hire an architect. It was a contractual kind of thing. It's not until after World War II that it became part of civic government. So it was sort of a big deal to hire him. It was an expensive affair. And Asheville ends up putting this comprehensive plan together and then really following it. You know, cities do those and they put them on a shelf and say, oh, yeah, big deal. But the city actually did something. It sat on it for a few years, but by 1925, did a great deal with it. And so I started studying this guy and then started studying Asheville and looking at urban Appalachia, which some people thought was sort of an oxymoron. But, you know, from us to Roanoke to, frankly, Pittsburgh, you know, there are significant parts of Appalachia that are urbanized. And so studied that and then came back and actually ended up on the faculty of my alma mater in teaching history at UNC Asheville and did that for many years and then got into university administration, still do that. And my main work is I worked for Western Carolina University, which is one of the 16 public colleges in North Carolina. The main campus is an hour west in Jackson County. It's a school of about 11,000, regional comprehensive. But we also have a graduate campus on the south side of Asheville, and I manage that for the university. And with that, still do a lot of talks about Asheville history because I love an underdog, and this is one of the few underdogs I've ever supported that actually won and has been victorious, so that's been great. And then, in addition to Well Play, I own the walking tour company here in town called Asheville by Foot, and we've got great guides that lead folks around and tell them stories about Asheville and the art and the architecture. So that's sort of my background.
You were talking a little bit about the city planning that went on in the 20s. Is that where we got all of the beautiful deco architecture downtown?
It is. And I'll take just a couple steps back just to give you a whole little framework. Asheville just starts off as a little sort of trading post, a stopover point for livestock drovers in the late 1700s and early 1800s, folks who are raising animals up in eastern Tennessee, mainly on their way to market in South Carolina, were coming through Asheville. And so much of what's the central business district today were big boarding houses with livestock pens in the back, place to cure your animals, dry place to lay your head, you know, a couple of hot meals, and you headed down the mountain. Asheville's remoteness kept it very secluded for many years. It kept it protected during the Civil War. Sherman was never going to march through Asheville. But then after the war in 1880, the railroad finally comes to Asheville. And there's a group of local physicians, actually, that begin to bill Asheville as a resort community, a place to come for whatever ailed you, fresh mountain air, four pretty moderate seasons, pretty even temperatures. It's never especially hot for long here or especially cold here. And there are also a number of hot and warm mineral springs around the Asheville area. And so we began to see a lot of folks coming out of the industrial heartland in the north, you know, the Philadelphia, New York, Boston, who would take the train and come down to Asheville. And they were coming for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, which also tells us, you know, the folks who were coming to Asheville were people of pretty significant means. And also the middle class, while burgeoning, still pretty small in this period. Paid vacations another 50 years in the future. So these are people of wealth coming to Asheville. Asheville, by the 1880s and 90s, had built a pretty significant tourism trade. One of the key things that we were very attractive to pulmonary patients, folks with lung conditions. We sort of laugh about that today in Asheville because anybody who moves to Asheville knows if there's something to be allergic to in North America, it grows here. Allergy season can be tough for newcomers. But we're particularly popular with tuberculosis patients.
Right.
To the point before the end of the century, we had garnered the reputation as the tuberculosis capital of the country.
Sexy.
Exactly. You know, if you're writing the Chamber of Commerce brochure for the city, you probably don't want it to say, you got TB? Come on down to Asheville. So there's a bit of a battle between hospitality and medicine, and they battle it out, and in the end, frankly, hospitality's got more political clout, and they pretty much legislate that out of business. So Asheville's got a pretty stiff tourism trade, and it's folks of wealth, and that's how the Vanderbilts get here. I always thought growing up as a kid that it was really strange. How did these folks ever find Asheville? Well, the truth is, the folks of the Vanderbilt social class had been coming to Asheville. What brought them here was one of the youngest of the Vanderbilts, George Vanderbilt. His mother contracted malaria, which is much more common than today, even in New York City.
Absolutely.
And he was the youngest grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who originates the Vanderbilt family fortune. He grew up on a farm in Staten Island, but then ended up being one of the so-called robber barons of the railroad age. It made him a ridiculously wealthy man. And his youngest grandson was George. And so George and his mother come here in 1888. A friend of the family, a fellow named Frank Cox, owned a resort hotel that was just not very far from where we're at right now, and invited her to come and spend part of the summer. And while they were here, they were on a horseback ride and came to a beautiful view of Mount Pisgah, which is out toward the west. That's our biggest peak in the county. And the legend is, he tells his mother, he said, we've had such a great time in Asheville that I'd like to build a summer retreat, a little place that the family can escape the hustle and bustle of New York.
We were at the Biltmore earlier today, so. That
absolutely. I mean, you know, in the end, he thought he was going to build a little modest Italian villa and then gets inspired to build a French chateau. And in the end, it's, you know, not only is it the largest house in the United States, it's one of the largest privately owned homes ever in history. You know, there's only a handful of larger houses in the world, and they are typically owned by a monarchy like Windsor Palace or the state, formerly owned by a monarchy like Versailles or something like that. I mean, even Windsor's not that much bigger than, when you take the cathedral off, than Biltmore is. I mean, Biltmore's 4.5 acres of interior floor space.
I mean,
it's like nine average American homes fit in the banquet hall. I mean, it's crazy.
How did that? Yeah, we were. I feel like at least one of the like the breakfast dining room that we were in. Dylan said, like, I'm trying to think of how many of my apartments would have fit in this single room.
The one with the leather wallpaper, too. You know, just a little something to do. What's crazy, here's the funny part. George was arguably the poorest of the Vanderbilts. Clearly all relative. Because he was the youngest. But the big thing was, when his dad passed, his brothers are almost 20 years his senior. So there's a big gap between the eight kids. It's the three oldest brothers, four sisters, and then him. And so when the time came to run the business, they did. He's still a kid. He never worked a day in his life. He didn't have to. He had significant inheritance and trust and perpetuity from his grandfather and his father. And that let him be a man of letters, too. He was very well learned. He read and spoke 8 different languages. He was ridiculously well traveled. They know today that he made more than 50 trips to Europe in his lifetime.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot, even by today's standards.
Yeah. When you can catch a flight and be there in
exactly.
7, 8
hours.
Exactly.
This is all by ship.
Heck.
Wow. And so he decides to build this house here. And his mother was very excited about it. And I think part of the reason was he was moving toward his late 20s and he's not married, which is a little long in the tooth in that day and
age. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's a great way to be seen as an eligible bachelor. So it takes almost 6 years to build it. He moves in 1895, still not married, much to his mother's chagrin. But he will marry in 1898 Edith Stuyvesant Dresser from an old New York family. His best buddy, Will, introduced them at a party in Paris. And so she'll become the lady of the land. And Biltmore's their primary home, but they also had houses in New York and D.C. and Paris. In fact, their house in New York's the only surviving Vanderbilt mansion. All the rest have been torn down, and it's Versace's headquarters on Fifth Avenue. <Sorry. laughs> Biltmore does a couple of things. It adds to the cachet. So now people follow the Vanderbilts like we follow Hollywood stars today.
Sure.
I mean, even you're in Podunk, USA, there was something in your newspaper about the Vanderbilts. So that became a big deal to come here. And even if you didn't know the Vanderbilts, you know, you could tell everyone, oh, we're going to Asheville, North Carolina. You know where the Vanderbilts live. We don't know the Vanderbilts. We're not staying with the Vanderbilts in their 32 guest rooms, but we're going to be there. And so that just increases the cachet. The other thing is that's really important to us is there were a group of artisans, architects, and craftsmen that came to work at Biltmore who were here for so long that they stayed. They basically built new lives here. And that's why Asheville's got such a great architectural collection that's much more substantial than most cities this size have. We'll see Asheville really begin to explode by the teens. Just to give an example of the population changes. By 1890, the population was only 10,000. By 1900, grown to 16,000. By 1920, we're at already 28,000. And in the 10 years of the so-called Roaring Twenties, nearly doubles to well over 50,000. Which today you're like, oh, that's not a big city at 50,000. Actually, when you look at the early 20th century and you look at cities, particularly in the South and how they're evolving, to be at that kind of growth rate in a short period was very much a sign it was on the path to being a major city. And there develops a bit of what I refer to as urban patriotism in Asheville that, you know, you got to be for Asheville. We're in for Asheville. And one of the ways was this Program for Progress, which was based on that John Nolan plan, the city planner. And that creates a whole explosion in growth in Asheville. And one of the features becomes this interest in Art Deco architecture. The first major building is the First Baptist Church that Doug Ellington, a North Carolina-born, but at that time Pittsburgh-based architect, did. Doug does several buildings in Asheville, and there are many others. We have one of the largest surviving collections of Art Deco. It's not the biggest in the country, but one of the things that's different, say, than like Miami, is we've got pretty much the full spectrum from the very early becoming more ornamented, looks a little bit like Art Nouveau as it transitions, all the way through the really highly ornamented, like our City Hall is a beautiful, stunning example of that, or the old S&W cafeteria building from 1929. I mean, it's as quintessential as you get in that style, all the way to the later period, which is a little more what they refer to as boilerplate, that it's sort of layered architecture and starts looking like internationalism or modernism as it becomes much less ornamented. So you can see the whole range here. But Asheville, because of that Program for Progress, really started going in this wild building spree, preparing for being a major Southern, if not a major East Coast city. And they began to just invest and invest. They did 97 projects from Nolan's plan, and all of that was funded in less than 4 years through municipal bonds. So by the time the stock market crashes, and then a couple of years later the bank that held the city's money crashes, the city and the county had a combined municipal debt of more than $54
million. Oh my goodness.
It's a lot. And to put it in perspective, today, that's $780 million for a town of 50,000. And in fact, it was the largest per capita debt of any city in the country. What's wild is by 1932, when most cities have started to declare bankruptcy, default on their bonds, Asheville refuses to default on the bonds, refuses to declare bankruptcy. People say, well, you know, we're good Appalachian stock. We pay our bills. And that's true, but I also know a lot of the guys in power own those municipal bonds. And if they didn't get their money, then maybe their grandchildren would, and that's who would. It took Asheville nearly 50 years to repay those Depression-era bonds off. And it does so on June 30th, 1976, and then 3 days later has a big bond-burning ceremony as a sign that the city had paid it all off. It's the only city in American history, actually, to repay all of its Depression-era bonds off. So it's something we're proud of, but what it did is it crippled the city. So for much of the 20th century, this city that had been on this meteoric rise comes to a meteoric crash, and even after World War II, while the rest of the Sun Belt South, from Los Angeles to Atlanta to Phoenix to Miami, they're all growing by leaps and bounds. We're not only not growing, we actually recede in population. The weird thing is, though, is the county will grow, particularly as northern industry comes south, cheap land, low-cost labor, very modest presence of unions, that brings a lot of that down. And our county, Buncombe County, would see that. But the city itself remains very small. In fact, the state wouldn't let it annex because it owed all this money, and so it keeps it real tight for a number of years. That's why even today, you'll go to old neighborhoods, and we're just putting sidewalks in for the first time.
Wow.
And the neighborhood's been there nearly 100 years. But we just didn't have any money to invest. But the other thing was, we didn't have any money to tear anything down either. And that's why so much of our historic fabric's still intact in Asheville. Things go really south by the 1970s with suburbanization, though. And that was not just us. That was everyone. Even, you know, Philadelphia and New York are really getting hit hard as folks abandon the city. And they're out in the suburbs, and shopping malls and shopping centers come up. And the same thing happens in Asheville. And once the department stores left the downtowns, the critical mass of people's gone. So there's not folks to go to the boutique shops and the restaurants and the theaters and all that. And so you end up like we did in Asheville with pretty much an abandoned downtown. But almost as quickly as we left, we had leaders that came back and said, well, you know, why don't we turn the misfortune of the Great Depression into our fortune today? All this stuff's still here, and began about 15 years before the rest of the country came back to the city. Asheville came back to its city. And by the mid-80s, it initiates a period we refer to locally as the Asheville Renaissance. And I argue that goes to about 2015. It's about a 30-year period.
Oh, my goodness.
Because at this point, we've revitalized, and now it's what's next for us. We're not recovering broken downtown. We've done that work. Now what's next? And so, you know, it's like you look across the street and you see new condo towers going in and new apartment buildings and things like that. To be frank, we play above our weight class in a lot of different things, like food and drink being really on the top of that. The music scene. Our music scene is not what a town our size has at all. I mean, we see major national and regional acts come through. And I think part of that is we're pretty close to Atlanta. We're close to Raleigh, we're close to Nashville, hell, we're even close to Birmingham, for that matter, relatively. And because of that, I think folks going through, and I think, frankly, they make a little vacay coming to Asheville. We'll play, we'll make our money, and then we'll get to. Plus, our venues are smaller, and sometimes even big bands. You remember, like a few years ago, Smashing Pumpkins decided to do sort of a new tour, and they did 6 dates in Asheville. They were in 3 cities. They were in like D.C., San Francisco, and Asheville. And they filled up in like 15 minutes being like, but partly they, you know, they're like, we play a lot of arenas, but sometimes it's nice to, you know, to be with the people. And so they're there with, you know, they're like in a place like the Orange Bill with 1,100 or 1,200 folks. So, and then there's 2 great, really highly reputed national recording studios here in Asheville. And so we see a lot of folks in the recording business come to do their work here in town. Stargazing's pretty easy in Asheville. You always sort of, on any weekend, see somebody. And people are sort of, they're real funny. They're real good about it. They don't really bother folks. But then you'll hear something on the radio and be like, I was just at the Bed Bath & Beyond. I saw Gladys Knight. And she was buying sheets.
Okay, I think it's time for an ad break. We'll be back after a quick word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
It sounds like Asheville has always been a tourist town, that a lot of business here, a tourist and health town. And so it's so interesting that you said medicine. I assume that you mean like corporations and not the kind of, you know, snake oil kind of stuff that was probably going on in the Victorian era.
You know, for us, we've got a very robust healthcare network. Our biggest employer is our healthcare system, Mission Healthcare. About 11,000 employees. I mean, they're the biggest employer this side of North Carolina, actually. Part of that, we've been such a popular retirement community, too, and throughout Western North Carolina, first with the so-called greatest generation and now with the baby boomers. There's a lot moving in. However, we were at points last year that millennials were moving into Asheville at a rate of 5-1 over baby boomers. We've just become real popular, 20 and 30-somethings, and wanting to move to Asheville. They like the vibe. They like the lifestyle. And even, you know, now later millennials, as they're starting to think about raising kids, Asheville's a great place. You can do that and not have to jump back into maybe what your stereotype perception of raising kids were when you were, you know, when your parents raised you and that kind of thing, that you can still sort of mix all that. I mean, you know, part of it is you see families at the breweries all the time. So that's a pretty common affair.
Yeah.
Our but it's, you know, and like that, our whole food and drink scene, most of that emerged out of the 90s in Asheville, though we actually go back to right at the late 70s and early 80s, particularly one chef, Mark Rosenstein. Mark opened a restaurant called The Marketplace, which is now Wall Street, but it used to be on Market Street. And food historians really consider Mark in that group of the original farm-to-table founders around the country. He was a very early pioneer in what came to be called farm-to-table. And now farm-to-table is so common in Asheville, we don't really call anything farm-to-table. That's just like calling it food. It's just, you know, it was like, used to, I grew a garden and had, you know, my little raised bed gardens in the back. And one time I was like, why am I doing this? We have all this great organic produce. I literally go down the street. We've got, you know, tailgate markets almost every day of the week throughout the city. And so it's just a great food scene. But most of that started to mature in the 90s. And then, as you all met with Leah and about her dad, Oscar. And Oscar is really very much the one that kicks off craft brewing in North Carolina. One of the key folks kicks it off on the East Coast. You know, I think when Oscar opened Highland, I think there were like 50 breweries in America. You know, there's over 5,000 now.
Wow.
He said he used to have a hard time even getting bottles. Like the first time he called to get a bottle order, you know, he needed so many thousand bottles, and they didn't even know what to do. I mean, they were used to, you know, Anheuser-Busch calling, and we need a million bottles or something like that. So early on, and the great thing, too, that, and I don't know if he wouldn't talk about it himself, but Oscar grew the industry by being cooperative. He always built an air of cooperation between brewers. He was never threatened as other brewers opened, but just pulled them in and grew the industry as well as his business. Brewing's really cooperative. I mean, nationally it is, and I think part of that is very much seen in Asheville. I mean, you go to any place and they've done cooperative beer making with somebody down the street. I mean, they're competitors, but nobody views it that way. Our, you know, we actually have a beer editor. you know, how many cities have a beer editor, right? Tony Kiss. And Tony was saying, maybe to me about a year ago, that you know, in any given week, it's about 350 different varieties of beer being brewed in Nashville, which is crazy. I mean, it's a lot of beer. And part of it, too, Oscar's one that points out, he said, you know, we've got the critical mass of breweries now, and some of the big national craft players like Oscar Blue and New Belgium and Sierra Nevada. But he said, the other thing is we have really good water in Nashville, and we have a lot of it. So we've seen that grow both brewing and now distilling, actually, is becoming more and more popular in Asheville and throughout North Carolina as well, and beyond, you know, sort of that moonshine kind of corn liquor stuff, but into everything from rums to Amaros to gins and Genevers and whatnot.
There was that dearth of brewing that was held over from, was that all held over from Prohibition?
Right.
Yeah.
And some of that's even more challenging in North Carolina, that what grew craft brewing more recently was when North Carolina did make a major change to go to high-gravity beers. Frankly, until the high-gravity beers, it just wasn't economically viable for most to think about having breweries, because you were really limited in the kinds of things you could brew. And so that's made a big difference. The state's been a little slow, but has been coming around. I mean, this was a state that went dry before the rest of the country went dry, back before Prohibition, and then it sort of struggled. I mean, we didn't have what was called liquor by the drink in Asheville until I think like 78, 79. We didn't even have national chain restaurants because none of those would come because they had bars. That's where the profit margin's at. I mean, I remember when Red Lobster opened up and people act like it was the second coming of Christ. They're like, oh my gosh, Red Lobster here in Asheville. And nothing bad against Red Lobster, but you know, today we make a little leap when we secretly go to chain restaurants. We just don't tell people. You know, everybody's got the chain restaurant they go to and their buddy they go with, and they just don't say I'm going to the Olive Garden or whatever. You know, you just go. Because I got the breadsticks and whatnot.
God. No, we
or those Cheddar Bay biscuits at the Red Lobster.
They're so good.
They're delicious.
We were saying earlier how strange it is, especially coming from Atlanta, which is a very corporate town, you know, with Coca-Cola and all of those other big corporations having their headquarters there, coming here and not really seeing many large corporate chains anywhere near downtown. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I've counted... Oh, I don't know.
Bar Taco.
And yeah. Farm Burger.
And Farm Burger. And those are small.
Those are small chains. Yeah. Like even in terms of clothing stores, like I think I saw an Urban Outfitters, but that was like, that's the biggest name that I've seen.
Yeah, there's an Anthropology around the corner. Both of them took a big hit when they opened. But I mean, you know, there was some protest about national chains being downtown. You'll notice there's no Starbucks downtown, though the word is they've really been looking hard to find a spot. But, you know, there's like 15 Starbucks out in the county. So you can still go do all that. But even out in the county, it's not even as much of a hard split as it used to be about downtown versus out in the burbs. The burbs have got great stuff now, too. Sometimes they've got second locations of downtown. What's getting funny is we've got some of our great restaurants have now started to expand around as well. Tupelo Honey's a great example. Where I'm having dinner tonight, Chaipani. There's a Decatur. Have you been to the Decatur one?
Oh,
They're fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Marwani, he was up for the James Beard this year on Indian street food. How awesome is that?
Yeah.
And it's funny, you'll hear people, it's not people are name dropping, it's still a small town. You know the folks. Mm-hmm. People say, oh yeah, I love going to Katie Button's place. And you know, they're talking about going to Curate, which is probably one of the most beloved restaurants in town. It's one of those that it's very popular with visitors, but it's still popular with locals as well. And you know, it's a 3 or 4 week wait to get a little reservation to get in.
And it's so interesting that you studied African history and that you still teach it, because I wanted to ask about, it's weird coming from Atlanta, which is such an integrated population, and coming to here where it seems like there are very few people of color, and it still is a southern city, like a lot of the mm-hmm. a lot of the foods, a lot of the culture is southern, but I mean it's Appalachian too, but yeah, could you speak a little bit to why that is?
Sure. So you know, inherently Asheville has a smaller African-American population even going back to mid-19th century history, and part of that had to do that there was not significant plantation agriculture in Western North Carolina, just because of the landscape. unlike the eastern part of North Carolina where they had these gigantic farms. But that does not mean there was not slavery in Western North Carolina. That becomes a real misunderstanding, and I think sometimes people want to sort of skip that and be like, oh yeah, we somehow, we're better than that. No, as a region, we have not been better than that. And there were slaves, but the number was smaller, and that has definitely been part of that inheritance. That said, though, after the Civil War, we were a very popular city for freedmen to relocate to. They were drawn to Asheville looking for new opportunities. There were folks like Isaac Dixon. Isaac was this amazing bootstrap story of this fella who, you know, sort of comes a nickel in his pocket, starts working mainly for the Patton family, I believe, which was an old Asheville family, and starts his own businesses, and then gets very concerned about African-American school kids, or mainly there weren't any schools for them to go to, particularly after the infamous Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, the codified Jim Crow laws. And in a story that we still don't fully understand, he gets appointed to the school board. I cannot imagine there are many African-Americans on Southern school boards at the turn of the 20th century, and he gets the city to build schools. They were segregated schools, but schools for African-American students. And so with that, there's it's an intriguing heritage. In the 1960s, there were students at the then all-black high school, Stevens Lee High School, who were so inspired by those four amazing young men at North Carolina A&T University that started the sit-in movement at the Woolworth in Greensboro. And they did the same thing. And they formed ASCOR, the Asheville Student Committee on Racial Equality, and began in 1961 their own campaign of desegregation to really great success over about a four-year period. And so we've definitely had really important and strong leadership that carries through. Population-wise, though, in the city, it's about half of what the average population in North Carolina, about 26% of all North Carolinians are of African descent. In Asheville, it's about 13% of all Ashevillians are of African descent. One of the challenges that we're very concerned about is some of our key areas that have begun to see more recent revitalization or new development are adjacent to historically African-American neighborhoods. And so the gentrification that wraps around that is very much a concerning thing for us in Asheville, because we don't want success to come create failure for somebody else, not of their own doing either. And so that's a lot of the conversation today about how do we balance those things in Asheville. And so, you know, I think it's something in meetings, things around town, we are talking about how do we as a city make sure that it is clear that we are a welcoming city for anybody to find what they're looking for in Asheville. You know, diversity gets used so much I'm in higher education, so it's a term we use a lot, but that it can almost lose its meaning. But I think fundamentally, cities that aren't welcoming will become irrelevant. Everybody's got to feel welcome. And it gets to a point that you want to see everybody and not just people that look like you. And if you're in a place that's not the case, it'll be irrelevant to you.
We still have some more interview for you. But first, a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Let's get back to the interview.
Can you speak at all to how, I guess, technology and industry? I mean, I know that the railroads were huge, and Asheville was one of the first places that had a bunch of different transportation related innovations in North Carolina. I think mm-hmm. I think I read that on Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. But
well, you know, if it's on Wikipedia, it has to be true.
Absolutely.
Actually, you know, today it's been vetted so many times, it's actually not as bad as it. You can actually find some real gems and all that. But anyway.
It's a good resource for resources.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about sort of the Asheville economy today, the tech sector is a really strong growth area. In fact, one of the things that we're an easy city, if you can be wherever you need to be, you don't have to show up at a particular office, and we have a ton of folks that are telecommuters that work for Atlanta-based companies and Raleigh-based companies and Boston-based companies that don't have to be there. and they can be anywhere in the world, and they choose to be here because they like the lifestyle of Asheville. They like the folks that are here. And so we see a lot of that. But we also have a number of homegrown businesses in Asheville that do great tech work, from high-tech manufacturing to, you know, apps and computer programming and things like that. We're not trying to be the new Silicon Valley or Silicon Mountain or anything like that, but just to, I mean, that's sort of, talk about trite. I mean, that's what everybody's been trying to do. But we, even a nearby community, Massingham, which is a pretty rural county, they've began putting greater investment in broadband infrastructure because they realize there are a lot of folks that want even a more rural kind of lifestyle, but they're high-tech employees. And they're seeing fruits from that, from those efforts already. You know, manufacturing's still very strong in North Carolina on the whole, even with the pretty much loss of textiles and furniture in the 1980s. But we still have a great deal of growth around that. And Buncombe County has a very strong manufacturing economy that supports not only our county, but a lot of the surrounding counties. We literally have tens of thousands of folks that live in adjacent counties and then come in to work in Buncombe County. That inflow is tens of thousands every day. And we'll see that we see in other regional economies around the country, but it's strong here and probably will be that way for the next, you know, 25 to 50 years for sure.
Speaking of, where do you think Asheville is going?
Where do I think Asheville's going? I think we'll continue to see population growth in Asheville. I think it'll be more limited than some of our sister institutions around our sister cities around North Carolina. I mean, you know, Raleigh and Charlotte are huge growth cities. We don't want to be a city of that scale. I think we'll continue to be a popular destination for folks looking for weekend visits. We're a really great driving destination. Though we're seeing tons of folks, my gosh, I just heard the figures on our airport. In less than five years, we will have doubled from about 500,000 passengers to over 1 million this year.
Oh my goodness.
And so we're seeing, but that's both good for us that live here and folks that are coming in. We're definitely struggling with becoming a popular city and the real estate issues that brings. We, you know, you frame it under the rubric of affordable housing, but it's a much more complicated thing than that. For us, it's a supply and demand. It's good old Keynesian economics. If you don't have enough supply and the demand's high enough, the prices jack up. And that's exactly what's happened with us. We just were, and I think it was Forbes this week, about being in one of the top 25 emerging boom markets. And we've been a boom market before. And frankly, we were all talking and thought, even the past few months, we were not dipping, but cooling a little bit. But Forbes is like, no, that's not what's happening. You're just getting ready to even hit higher heights on that. And that makes us anxious, though, as somebody pointed out, and it's sort of harsh. They said, what good city do you know is cheap to live in? I'm like, well, that's true. They said, and all the peer cities that folks be like, well, you know, Asheville reminds me a lot of a smaller Portland or Austin or Boulder or something. Those are crazy expensive cities to live in. And not that that's something we're aspiring, and we'd be glad to rewrite that chapter. But I think that will be a challenge for us. And then hand-in-hand in that is transportation. We've outgrown our infrastructure right now for the automobile. And part of that growth we're seeing downtown, people are tired of getting in their cars, and they're wanting to walk places. The other thing, in some ways this seems a little preemptive to talk about, there's a great deal of conversation that goes on in Asheville about autonomous vehicles, which seems a little space age, but already we're starting to see those pull up more than we thought. And our transportation folks have begun seriously having conversation about what would that look like? You know, do you not have parking decks? No, you've still got cars. You don't want robot cars just roaming the streets at all time. They got to go somewhere because it's also not good energy-wise. You don't want them just using up energy waiting on somebody pull their phone out and call a car to them. So it'll be interesting to see how the impact that will have. I think one of our challenges, it's the really best challenge to have. Our unemployment's ridiculously low. It's the lowest in North Carolina and has been for over 3 years. It's the lowest it's been here since like 2000. It's like 3.2, 3.4 this week, which basically means you don't have unemployment. It's just frictional unemployment of people moving jobs. And in fact, in Metro Asheville, there's more than 10,000 vacant jobs right now. And so we're actually running into the issue of having enough people to support the infrastructure that's here and growing in terms of business and manufacturing and other related. Because even things like nonprofits are a huge, sounds weird to say, nonprofits are big business in Asheville. There are so many local, regional, and national nonprofits headquartered in Asheville that at one time there was a figure like one out of every 11 people were employed by a nonprofit in Metro Asheville. And I'm not sure what the current status is of that. It's a lot of folks. I mean, it's very common to be meeting folks and they work for nonprofits in town for sure.
So you kind of mentioned the vibe of Asheville, and that's why people move here. And it's really interesting to talk to someone who's from Asheville. What do you think, since we are sort of trying to focus in on the food and drink, but in general, why do you think, what is the vibe to you, and what brings, from our experience so far, the food and drink scene has been amazing. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is?
So the bigger sort of vibe, I actually go back to there's a bit of old Appalachian sensibility of live and let live, and who am I to judge you? Or put another way, if you stay out of my business, I'll stay out of your business. And part of that really means that it's not tolerance. I don't really care for that word. But just acceptance, and that we may not see eye to eye, and that's okay. I don't hate you because you don't agree with me, which on a cultural perspective nationally, that's a little short in happening today.
Yeah.
Asheville, that sort of food and drink vibe, I think you still can connect with all of that. There's a couple of things that went on. You know, first in the late 60s and early 70s, we had folks moving to Asheville out of places like Northern California, you know, the so-called flower children, hippie movement and all that. And they were drawn to Asheville for a couple of reasons. One, frankly, it was cheap to be here. And so for young folks looking for a place to be, and maybe they were artists, or maybe they were interested in farming, or whatever they were interested in, and this sort of jived and worked well for that. Also, being in the Appalachian Mountains, arguably the Appalachians are the oldest mountain range in the world. Our French Broad River, so named because it was the Broad River that went west into French territory in the old days. People are like, it's a weird name. That's our main, one of our two rivers that go through the county. It's the third oldest river in the world. And so with that, there are also people drawn to Asheville for a bit of that. I mean, you may frame it as spirituality or the connection to the land. Part that goes, of course, back to great Cherokee heritage in Western North Carolina as well. And so folks can get drawn to that. And then there was this time by the 80s and 90s, and I actually put it back, of all things, back to tobacco. Some folks will remember that it's in the 90s in the Clinton administration that the federal government started winning these big cases against big tobacco. And it was a real hit on tobacco, to the point that tobacco was not as profitable a crop. Well, tobacco has been a huge crop in North Carolina for, you know, a couple hundred years. And a lot of folks in Western North Carolina, where it was always harder to grow than Eastern North Carolina, again, that sort of landscape and whatnot. And so they got out of it. And as they were looking to get out of it, there was a group called the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project that started getting folks into sustainable agriculture, namely around food production. And so there is no table and farm to table without the farm. And so the farm started growing at the same time the table was growing in Asheville. And so we began to see farming for food really both coming back and really growing in Asheville. And that's really helped support that scene. So you got folks like Mark Rosenstein starting the marketplace that could get to local produce. Early Girl Eatery down the street's a great example. They were one of the first ones. You know, if they could get it local, they got it local. And that's pretty standard. I mean, you even go to chain restaurants in Asheville, and there literally are stickers on the menu that they buy their meat at Hickory Nut Gap Farms or something like that, that even though that's not where their national supply normally comes from. So I think that going hand in hand, and again, once you get a bit of a critical mass, and frankly, when you got enough people that both live here and visit here to come and eat, you can make some of those jumps in food and put a lot more restaurants per capita than you would expect to see here for sure. And there's also a great AIR, which is the Asheville Independent Restaurant Association, is extremely good at what they do in promoting and supporting the local restaurant and food culture. And so it's a very cooperative, and people help each. Again, they're in competition with each other, but I mean, literally, like at Well Played, our board game cafe, there are times we run out of something and we can go next door to the Laughing Seed, and you know, it's barring a cup of sugar, so to speak. And we help each other out like that all the time. There's not a sense of cutthroat competition in the food scene here. And then we've gotten to the point that we're just sort of proud of it. Katie Button, for example, that has Currite and Night Bell, Katie made it all the way to the last round of James Beard this year. And we were sort of following her like it was a sports team. Just, well, Katie's got to win this year. Unfortunately, Katie didn't get it this year. But we're like, Katie's got, we got it. She's got to win. And, you know, in any given year, we've got anywhere from 2 to 4 folks up for a James Beard in some way. And so that becomes a little bit part of the hometown culture even.
Yeah, that's great. Everyone that we've spoken to has spoken to the point that that even the competition is friendly and collaborative.
The challenge can be is that, of course, people still vote by their feet or their backside in the seat. And so it can be tough that, you know, if you don't bring some game, you don't last. Restaurants come and go in Asheville often. So you got to bring some game for sure. Like bar food in Asheville isn't bar food anywhere else. It's pretty serious food. You just can't get away with basics.
What do you think? And this is a big question, but what nostalgia wise, when you think of Asheville as someone who grew up here, especially, what is the food that comes to mind? What is the food that like brings you back to Asheville?
So it's funny, growing up in Asheville, growing up in Appalachia, I mean, I definitely, you know, grew up in a household where we had country fried steak and we had pinto beans and cornbread and green beans and things like that. But it weirdly sort of grew up in Asheville, it was also about moussaka and spanakopita. We have a really big Greek Orthodox population in Asheville. And for a number of years, a number of the local restaurants were owned by Greek families. And so you might go and it had diner fare and you can get some meatloaf and, you know, carrots and green beans. But then you could also get, you know, pastikko and moussaka and whatnot. And so that was also part of it as well. It's funny, the Asheville Citizen Times, our local paper, just did an article last week on, I think it was them who did, on the 10 top restaurants that people remember that are not around anymore. And it's funny to sort of see what some of the themes, and one was one I just mentioned called Stone Soup. And I remember as a kid, I mean, they were doing artisan before anybody used artisanal as a phrase for food. And it was exactly, it was a soup and sandwich shop that did their own home-baked breads. And those of us who, I would, as a kid growing up, the people remember it to the point that literally the staff has reunions. They get together folks that used to work at this restaurant. You know, I don't think we've seen, there are things that come and go, but it's not, it's not excessively trendy in Asheville. We don't have a toast restaurant. You know, you can go to San Francisco and they're the toast restaurant. And I got nothing wrong with toast restaurants. But those are ones that probably, at least in a town our size, won't have a longevity. Folks typically try to open with some longevity intended and not just sort of catching a trend for sure. It's a lot of small plates more recently though, and I think part of that comes to folks like me. You know, you love a sampler. You got to try a little bit, this, that, and the other thing. I think the distilling scene is actually really interesting that's begun to evolve in Asheville, and it's tied to finally, what was a late maturing craft cocktail scene. We were so beer-centered in Asheville that the craft cocktail was not particularly strong. And then we saw folks like Sovereign Remedies, that is hands down my favorite bar in town. And they not only do beautiful, beautiful drinks, but great, great food as well. In fact, their chef just got invited to the James Beard House. Graham's going to be doing a thing up here in a couple of weeks. And they're also the owner. His partner has a urban farming, and they do infill on lots and front yards, and do CSAs out of that, but then they also, you know, it is produce for the restaurant as well. And I just love that. I mean, that is such a great way to connect in with land, connect with food, and know who you're buying your food from. And so I think that scene's been one that was a little later for us that has finally become stronger. The other thing is we're actually seeing other food manufacturing happening in Asheville. We talk about the food scene in terms of what we go to restaurants, but the actual food production scene is pretty robust as well. Everything from Roots Hummus, which has become a major regional and growing national hummus maker, and they do great flavors of it that you can get in a restaurant, but you can also buy in the store, to Bucci Kombucha. And they have become one of the major national players in kombucha and other kinds of fermented drinks. In fact, they just started even doing stuff overseas in South Korea. Soda makers we've been seeing Red Devil's of most recent one, Waynesville Soda Jerks from a couple years ago, and they're still in production. Chocolate making, French Broil Chocolate Lounge, literally makes tons of chocolate, and they are now building a new production facility here. Most of their tonnage, literally tonnage, goes to their main shop downtown. But they're going to start, as I understand it, do craft chocolate for commercial use, like baking chocolates and chocolate chips and syrups and whatnot. And having the restaurant, we actually don't have many great choices for chocolate that it's just the big global commercial stuff. There's not, if you're looking for a more craft brand, there's just not a lot to turn to. And so they're going to fill that niche. So I think that's the other part of food and drink that can get missed in Asheville. And then the list just goes on and on of the folks who make, you know, everything from jams and jellies to just great, you know, time of day, you know, day foods from great bakeries and other kinds of food like that. So then some of the times, you know, the demand on that has really sometimes outstripped the supply. And so we've seen some maneuvers and growth having to happen because of a need for that. And that gets, you know, for some of those businesses, it gets them at that point of thinking, at what point am I getting beyond local? And I've become I'm becoming my own big multinational, not a big multinational, but you know, major affair. And of course, the other, and y'all may have already sampled a little bit there, but are the food trucks. And of course, a lot of cities have seen good food truck scenes. It's interesting for Asheville, we don't actually allow food trucks to be on the sidewalks. They have to either be in designated lots or tied with another business. So most of our food trucks are actually at the tap houses. And they cycle around all of the beer production facilities, sometimes one by one or sometimes two or three, but that's typically where you go find. There's, I think, just heard recently 40-some, 50-some food trucks in Asheville with, I mean, everything from Indian to Korean fusion, Korean-Mexican fusion to French and the grilled cheeses and sort of everything in between.
Yeah, I don't remember what brewery it was at. We've been at a number of them. But one of them had like a food truck of the day board up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's the gig. Like, this is how, I mean, that's great.
And you're now finding places in unexpected, there's a good story actually, are the unexpected restaurants. For example, it's the great Thai food that's at the Exxon. Or it's there's a place up north. This woman makes these fantastic homemade tortillas, and she's like in, you know, the back of the gas station as well. And it's, and those they make, and when they sell out, they sell out. You know, they're homemade there. There's even rumors of sort of the hidden restaurant scene that are in people's houses that just are not, they're not official, but people go have their own little setups. So there's that food is very robust. And I think in Asheville, frankly, it's feeling a bit more to me what my European friends feel about food, of just really demanding quality. Why am I going to put junk in my body? This is my body. Why am I going to put all these chemicals and all this other stuff? And now there's enough critical mass that it's actually financially viable for these farms and producers in the region.
And that's the end of our interview this our first bonus interview from Asheville. There will be more.
Oh, yes.
Yes. We hope you enjoyed it and found it as informative as we did. Mm-hmm. And we hope to hear from you.
From you?
From you, all of you listeners out there.
Yes, please.
Yes. If you would like to email us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Dylan Fagan. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.